Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
It's great to have you here tonight, and we have two very distinguished speakers, but we've got a title, Taking Back the Classroom, Reclaiming Education, and because Dr. Catherine Runcie wanted to sit to talk, we've got her up here like the headmistress at the classroom. She's at the desk. And she's been sitting here keeping an eye on you all, and she'll be giving out lines if any of you misbehave. So we're taking back the classroom tonight, and we have David Roberts. Yes, I began to think I had the wrong name for a moment, who's talking to us a little bit about Menzies and education, which
right.
is something we've forgotten. But we're going to start with Dr. Catherine Runcie, who's going to give us some idea of where this project started, why it started, and what it's trying to do. Dr. Catherine,
thank you,
it's all yours.
Recently, I had the privilege to complete my editing a book I'd been working on for quite some time. It was launched by the, indeed, very honorable Peter Baldwin. Retracing some of my steps to its completion with co-editor David Brooks, a former colleague at the University of Sydney, was my introduction to Reclaiming Education, Renewing Schools and Universities in Contemporary Western Culture. In the time allotted, may I sketch how this book began? It began modestly with a telephone call from a dear family friend, in fact, godfather to one of our children, Emma. Our friend was lamenting how no one remembered his Uncle Bob anymore. No one even realized his views on education. That struck me particularly, as I too did not fully realize Sir Robert Menzies' ideas on education. Nor did a celebrity or two, who thanked another politician for the new idea of a free university education. In fact, Whitlam got the thanks for all of this. We fell to lamenting education itself, which David Menzies knew well. After all, he lived in Victoria, and Victoria had been going through the so-called safe schools controversy, the safe space controversy, and the sexist traffic light controversy, and much, much more. I did know this, however, that education in whatever Australian state is a never-ending source of opinion. Issues are debated in newspapers and magazines across the land every day. Phonics is good. Phonics is bad. Rote learning is good. Rote learning is bad. Sight words are good. Sight words are bad. Times tables are good. Times tables are bad. Calculators are good. Calculators are bad. Online is good. Online is bad. NAPLAN is good. NAPLAN is bad. Exam stress is good. Exam stress is bad. And it gets more complicated and more indecisive as you move up through the years at school. I suspect today's teachers have a very tough time. Teachers should be your buddy. Teachers should not be your buddy. And if you have to give a pupil or student a low mark, that might be buddy betrayal. Teachers have to remember that egalitarianism must reign supreme. And in the land of Oz, egalitarianism means sameness, in spite of all evidence to the contrary. Of course, if you're a sports person, you are allowed to be an elite, the best, the greatest, the superstar, even, in fact, to get a PhD. Just not so in the classroom, where you're merely learning to be earning for the rest of your life. By the time the HSC rolls around, or should that be the baccalaureate, if a teacher is still confident and happy in the job, has anybody ever asked them? And if a student is still confident and optimistic too, have they missed the national neurosis of doubt and dismay and endless opinions that yank your mind this way and that? Small wonder that Australia came in below Kazakhstan in literacy and numeracy. A very dear learned friend from Sri Lanka, Cambridge-educated citizen of the world, now retired professor of English, once asked me decades ago, in the 1970s, when are Australians going to stop experimenting on themselves on education? And after all these years later, one might answer, never. But never is too long a time. I decided to do a book of essays that would show some certainty, some clarity, essays which would yield helpful deep learning, written by scholars who would know that they know. I read hundreds, maybe thousands of contradictory newspaper items, articles from magazines, and even surfed heavy tomes, like that of the Royal Society of Economics, whose most recent issue is on gender. I knew a brainy, willing publisher, and I consulted friends who were and are outstanding teachers, colleagues, and scholars. Thus, former colleagues Barry Spurr and David Brooks helped generously and right away. And Karina Heppner, who knew high school teaching in various countries and in more than one language, helped instantly, as did the other learned scholars whom we approached or who were recommended, some of whom are here tonight. And for some scholars, I searched down memory lane, recalling outstanding papers given to the Sydney Society of Literature and Aesthetics, a society I formed with philosophers in other language departments as well as my own, the English department, in the 1980s to get papers that would run an argument, learned, logical, and lucid, not bombastic, blustering, and bent. Alas, we so often get this today. Just mention the word Ramsey Center, and you know blustering, bombastic, and bent. That we did not want, and that we did not get. The scholars who so willingly gave papers to the project of this paper eschewed all faux learning and faux reasoning and tricky argument. The scholars simply knew too much and were too serious to slant what they had to say in what The Economist magazine calls millennial Marxism, or what one might call kitsch Marxism. I prefer kitsch Marxism. It indicates the symbiotic, the watered down, the misunderstood. In fact, I think it's the anti-Warhol of politics. You can take me up on that later. In fact, it is not Marxism at all. An older understanding of Marxism, led 40% of humanity to famine, gulags, and constant fear. It blindsided many thinker politicians with so much of the scientific, the dialectical, and therefore the inevitable, that they let totalitarianism trample the utopian fading away of the state and trample those human beings who got in the way of scientific inevitability. Millennial Marxism, or kitsch Marxism of today, is less Marxism than parasitic opportunism. It is aiming largely to ramp up your rage or revenge or envy or ignorance to get a power edge, ironically, in the midst of democracy and its plenitude of rights. You could not have tried the maneuvers of the kitsch Marxists of today in a country that is attempting to be Marxist, which, as it just so happens, has to be totalitarian. When applied to the education of the young, kitsch Marxism nevertheless has a single taproot that is one of history's crimes. I don't think that's saying too much. I think it's a crime. Using others, using the young or the infirm or the poor, the vulnerable, to your own ends. A significant but tiny presage, however, does exist in the older genuine Marx, and it has seeped through as Marx's legacy inside a democracy. You need no scientism for it. In Marx's letters, a litany of mooching and manipulation, he writes this in 1868 to Ludwig Kugelmann. when planning the first international. I quote, "Anybody who knows anything of history also knows that great social changes are impossible without the female ferment. Social progress can be measured exactly by the social status of the beautiful sex, the ugly ones included." Use the vulnerable. Use the vulnerable as a means to an end. It is no surprise, just profoundly sad, to know Joan Kerner, the erstwhile premier, the state of Victoria, said at a Fabian Society meeting that schools had to become, quote, part of the socialist struggle for equality, participation, and social change. What she says is the canary in the mine of democracy. In other words, use persons' minds, use young persons' minds during school. Use the innocent, the vulnerable. The scholars who so kindly said yes to reclaiming education were learned enough to know right from wrong. To have goodwill towards the whole enterprise of learning, the past and present for the future. I was so fortunate in the responses from scholars who are now in the book, Persons of Integrity. Did I have knockbacks? Yes, several. Some are unexpected. I found no IT expert, although I tried in Australia, in the United Kingdom, and in Canada where I had contacts, and I could not contact some deeply learned Aboriginals whom I so admired, even though I went through Nigel Scullion and he was helpful with addresses. No reply to my queries. I suppose the rudest knockback was from a female, suffering sisterhood, was from a female academic lawyer teaching at an unnamed university. Her reply to me went along the lines of, why bother with Western civilization anyway? Her position and her opinion were in such patently ironic contrast, a lawyer in a university today, that I did write back and say so. In spite of knockbacks, I did get to the stage of a newer text. Scholars will know what that is. I don't know if I can lift it up. But anyway, it's full of marvelous pictures that we weren't allowed to have. Can look at it perhaps later. The Urtext had a dazzling array of learned essays, but also dazzling visuals of photographs from scholars Lynn Ashcroft, Ivan Head, David Daintree. So seeing is believing, but in a collection of essays, seeing is also relieving. The Urtext had shrewd but kind help from philosophical mathematician Professor James Franklin, and shrewd but kind editorial help from a lady who is Hugh's airhead, Shelley Gare, who's now traveling by train in America with her smartphone, said hello not long ago. And then Dr. Christopher Allen, the preeminent art historian, suggested to me the Vincenzo Foppi fresco of 1464 of young, innocent Cicero reading. And David Brooks, co-editor and essay writer, bought the copyright for us from the Wallace Collection, London. Very stringent, the rights to that picture. Alas, all this bounty of photography was too expensive to reproduce, and the Urtext was boiled down to just two visuals, a black and white frontispiece, I passed it. Yeah. Black and white frontispiece. It's in color in here. Taken by Ivan Head. It is of Southwark Cathedral and the Shard. No, not monuments to God and Mammon, which is probably what Sir Kenneth Clark might have said, but both attributes of Western culture. The cathedral was built over the site of 800 years of churches, and the Shard by Renzo Piano solved amazing engineering problems, as did the Sydney Opera House. The Urtext at the hand of a patient publisher became this. Edwin Lowe designed the cover, and in this case, you can tell a book by its cover. What emerges in this book is collegial generosity, sheer brain power, outstanding insights amid deep and varied learning, and that sine qua non, bravery, a refusal to be intimidated. The writers and thinkers whom I was lucky enough to have contributed truly want the youth of today to know the accumulated and interlocking truths of mankind, to show modern youth those shoulders of giants, I may quote, to stand on. Shoulders of giants to stand on. Available in our society as never before, which are necessary to prepare the young for the future. Getting to the final text was a 3-year process. Scholars wrote sometimes through great sadness, some, like the late beloved Richard Gill, through great sickness. In my own household, we came close to needing a standby ambulance to St. Vinny's. But even if reclaiming education finally is just a pebble in a pond, we all know pebbles create widening ripples, and the pebbles are tough. I hope you enjoy this effort and that one gets a better understanding of many things, one of which is Sir Robert Menzies and education. Thank you. David, over to you.
Okay, we'll now hear from David, Ms. Roberts, and take you back in time to Robert Menzies.
Well, thank you very much, Anne and Jared, and especially Catherine as well, for her wonderful effort in compiling and editing this great volume of Reclaiming Education. And I would highly commend the volume to you, and there are some copies for sale tonight. So I specifically focused on Menzies and his philosophy and approach to education, which was a chapter in the volume. And so I'll just start off speaking about Menzies' educational philosophy and how it evolved, and also his outlook on university education and his achievements also in schools education, and then just finally to draw some lessons from Menzies for the state of education today. So beginning with Sir Robert, he was born, of course, in Japarit in 1894. And he had a Scottish Presbyterian upbringing. And this, of course, was very relevant to his evolving philosophy of education. So there were really two sort of streams of thought that Menzies imbibed, which would shape his approach to education. And the first was the Scottish Presbyterian upbringing, where he believed that people found their primary identity not in any class or race or sexuality, but as beings created in the image of God. And so this meant he believed in a common humanity for all. And he said, indeed, in a radio broadcast in the early 1950s, that the primary purpose of education is to instill in people an understanding of their relationship to each other and their relationship to their creator. Now, the second great influence was, of course, the Scottish Enlightenment, especially through John Locke, who was an English philosopher, but also David Hume and Robert Burns. And this instilled in Menzies a great love of learning, because the Scottish tradition really shares with Confucianism and also Judaism a very highly prized view of learning and of scholarship. And Menzies imbibed that, and he believed that learning and scholarship was essential to human progress and to the flourishing of civilization. And so he naturally excelled academically. He was raised by both his parents, James and Kate Menzies, who instilled in him a love of learning. And he excelled in his own right when he scored very high grades at primary schools in Jeparit and later Ballarat before winning a scholarship to Melbourne's Wesley College, after which time he read law at the University of Melbourne. And his legal studies, of course, were complemented by studies in English literature and in history. And these furnished him with a deeper understanding of human nature. Now, I want to talk a bit about Menzies' philosophy of university education in particular. And in 1939, he gave an address where he explained what he saw as a sevenfold purpose of a university. And it's worth just enumerating these 7 points in brief. That first of all, a university is to be a home of pure culture and learning. Second, a training school for the professions. Third, a link between academics and workers. And this is especially important, especially today, when often intellectuals are pitted against workers. And we sort of have this culture where there's this big divide where the two have radically different worldviews. But it was Menzies' belief that these two people, these two groups, should be reconciled to each other. Now, fourthly, the home of research. Fifthly, trainer of personal character. Sixthly, a training ground for leaders in all fields of endeavour and public life. And finally, a custodian of mental liberty and search for the truth. Now, of course, Menzies was both a traditionalist and a moderniser. So on the one hand, he was committed to the traditional medieval function of universities to be the great incubators of our culture and civilisation, and not just degree factories with the utilitarian objective of churning out as many graduates as possible. At the same time, however, he was also a visionary, and he saw universities in Australia especially as fulfilling an important role. As much as he was an Anglophile, he believed that Australian universities needed to stop looking to Oxbridge or the US Ivy League universities and instead focus on cultivating their own crop of homegrown Australian academics and researchers. And he also envisaged Australian universities as playing an important role in the Asia-Pacific region, especially against the backdrop of the Colombo Plan initiated by his government, where universities would host promising students from Asia and the Pacific regions to come and study. And these universities in turn would equip these students to return to their home countries in Southeast Asia and India and other places to build up tertiary institutions in those countries as well. And moreover, he envisaged a greater role for women and female students at universities. As early as 1942, he said in an address that university education for women must not be seen as an eccentricity of a blue stocking, but as a normative destiny for girls finishing high school, that university would be a normal pathway for them. And indeed, the participation of women increased at universities during his time in office from less than 20% in 1952 to almost 26% by 1962. Now, Menzies presided as Prime Minister over the great expansion of the university sector And he, of course, was responsible for commissioning the Murray Report into higher education in 1956, which released its report the following year. And Sir Keith Murray was of like mind to Menzies. He was also a traditionalist and had a non-utilitarian philosophy of university education, but also a vision to see it come within the grasp of more Australians. And so Menzies, as Prime Minister, presided over the growth of universities and the establishment of several new ones, including the University of New England, Monash University, Macquarie, La Trobe and Flinders, and the number of students increased markedly during his time in office. So I think that there are some important lessons today from Menzies' approach to education. And the first one is that he highly esteemed the arts and humanities. Of course, in his time, he was Prime Minister during the space age, and so there was that focus on science and technology, which he appreciated in terms of advancing Australia's technological capacity. But he never lost sight of the importance of arts and humanities in cultivating the finer human virtues of faith and responsibility and duty to one's country. And so he very highly esteemed the liberal arts disciplines of history and literature and philosophy and so forth. And I think today we can learn from that. I think that many on the conservative side of politics have this view, rightly, that because a lot of arts faculties have become beholden to more sort of radical philosophies of postmodernism and critical theory, which has sort of given rise to a culture of political correctness and identity politics, that therefore these arts faculties should be starved of funding and not supported. But I think, on the contrary, that arts and humanities in Australia can be redeemed. I think it's first of all important that we invest in these arts and humanities disciplines, and the Ramsay Centre for Western Civilization is a very welcome initiative which will help rejuvenate the arts faculties in many of our public universities with extra funding, and also a renewed focus on the foundational traditions and values that have informed our Western civilization. Furthermore, I think we can also invest in more liberal arts colleges. Australia, unlike the United States, does not have a proliferation of liberal arts colleges. Our tertiary education system is still very heavily dominated by public institutions. But I think that if we value the diversity of public and private schools at the primary and secondary levels, why not strive for the same thing at the tertiary education level with a diversity of different higher education institutions? And there are some promising green shoots, if you like, in the higher education sector in Australia. We have some new small liberal arts colleges emerging, for example, Sydney's Campion College, which was founded by Carl Schmood about 10 or 15 years ago. We also have the universities of Notre Dame in Sydney and Perth, and also a sort of Protestant Pentecostal college known as Alpha Crucis, which appears to be very much an institution on the move. And so I think these newer colleges, they may not have the sandstone cloisters and spires of the old universities, but in a way they are truer to the original universities in their vision to foster a love and understanding of the arts and humanities, not just for knowledge sake, but to enrich moral character and for our civilization to grow and to flourish. Now, I think to conclude, one of the reasons why Menzies was vested so heavily in education was that he understood politics to be downstream from culture. In other words, if you wanted change to happen at the political level, it was first of all necessary to tend to nurturing the culture. And he saw higher education institutions as critical to nurturing our culture, which in turn would inform our politics. So thank you very much.
I'm going to hit your microphone. I'm going to turn it on. Thank you very much, David and Catherine. We've got a problem with having a microphone for the camera. So Paige over there has a handheld microphone for you to ask a question. But because it's going to be difficult to pick up the questions, we're going to ask you to make your questions fairly concise and talk loudly into the microphone. But I'd just like to start off with a thought. Some years back, a well-connected Sydneysider said to me, in growing up, it helps if you can choose your parents. And I just wonder if this explosion of emotive politicisation of our universities and schools now, it seems, how important is it that parents play some role in what's happening to institutions? Because it is their babies that these institutions are going to turn out. So maybe Catherine, you can start, and then we'll go to David. And David, just stay there.
Thank you.
Well, I certainly... Is that on?
That's on.
I certainly don't think wealth is a factor, especially...
Well, I didn't mean wealth, I meant values.
Values. I would say in some cases, because children can be rebellious, if a parent thinks education is for stupid people, and I had an aunt who thought only stupid people would get an education because smart people didn't need it, I think you could have somebody rebellious against a view like that. And there are lots of parents, after all. Today there are parents who aren't in two husband and wife relationships, and sometimes that might make a child shy and shy in a classroom. There are all sorts of factors, far too many, I think, to mention. I think the home does influence. It can for better or for worse. But the one myth that you get, and I think particularly in Australia, which plays envy politics really hard here, and that is that if your parents are wealthy, you will get to go to university and to the best universities and so on. Well, maybe it can get you into year one, 101, but it won't keep you there because you do have to be of a certain standard to pass from year to year. So I think that is important, that it is not always that you have to come from a so-called wealthy family or an affluent family. I think it helps if your parents have any kind of an interest, intellectual interest, and by that I don't mean anything, you know, up in the clouds, but I mean just reading a little bit of history or taking a magazine like the National Geographic. Those things can help a great deal. And but they're not necessarily determinative. I think that, in fact, what ultimately is the child itself, it's so complicated. Learning, sitting in a classroom, as a child, as an adolescent, then as an undergraduate, the complexities are so great that I think you can't put it down to the home factor alone. Even a very poor home can produce students who are really very eager to learn. And a teacher might even do that for you. So, David, have I taken too much time?
So just to recap, just to recap the question, please.
My question was really not about money. My question was about that parents want to see their children have a good education, and if they're going into institutions where they're being taught to just protest against climate change and not learn history, maths, or whatever, eventually, as a pressure group, couldn't the parents be a way of changing the way governments look at what institutions should be in education? That's all I'm saying.
I'm sorry, I didn't take that from your question.
As a pressure group, if we're seeing our institutions not bringing the outcomes that we want, surely we can expect our parental group to want better outcomes and therefore to pressure those that look after these institutions to make them better. That's all I thought.
Yes, indeed, that's a very important point that education at whatever level is, of course, a partnership between the parents and the institution, be it the school or indeed the university. And I think, as Catherine alluded to, it's parents who have that fundamental role in their children's earliest years of instilling their values and their worldview, which are then further nurtured by their school and the university, if they indeed they proceed to higher education. And I think we want to see both parents and educational institutions working with each other and certainly not against each other. And I think that if there can be a consensus on the values that they teach, then that will make it a lot easier for the child and the student who's learning, and also the school and the parents that are educating this child in a partnership, essentially.
I think parents can be very intimidated by a school. I think parents can be intimidated by a school, particularly if you're talking about so-called political correctness. I mean, there have been moments when I felt myself I should go to a school principal and just say, you know, this should not be so. And my own children pleaded with me not to do that for my grandchildren's sake because they felt it would mark their child out. And I think we have to be realistic about that. This so-called PC is quite aggressive, and parents have to recognize that if they're going to do something, maybe they should do it in a group that couldn't be ignored.
There's a question down back here.
Thanks both of you for speaking on what might be maybe a sort of prickly subject sometimes, but a question for David first. Robert.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned the, for example, Ramsey Centre. How does one overcome the almost vitriolic reaction by some of the universities to even the idea of introducing that particular course?
Yes, well, you're right. There has been a lot of resistance to the Ramsey Centre, and it's an opposition that won't be easily overcome, but it's no reason, I think, for us to give up. I think we should persevere through persuasion and advocacy to put our case forward for Western civilization studies in our public universities under the Ramsey Initiative, and that's something we should continue to work on. It will encounter a lot of opposition, but it's something we should continue to advocate. But at the same time as doing that, we also, I think, need to invest in alternate spheres of education as well, especially in the liberal arts colleges and other private education providers as well.
Do you want to comment, President?
I think that, in fact, the opposition to the Ramsey Center is very specific to a few people. I mean, people who were... It was orchestrated. It was not, in fact, something that just came out of the green grass on the lawn of the quad, right? It was orchestrated by people who had absolutely determined political ideas and who really saw with quite mistaken ideas that the Ramsey Center was somehow, for white supremacy. These were fantasies of, in fact, the person that at Sydney University who was so anti-Ramsey and who orchestrated so many people to sign up his petition against it. And there's one in Wollongong as well, and I think there's another one going on in Queensland. This particular person was really quite a malcontent, and he saw things in... He saw it as almost evil, that it was going to be racist and, you know, whereas I would like to think that what Ramsey, and certainly when they published the books that they thought would be amongst the books that they would talk about at universities or have taught, they really were standing, if I can use Isaac Newton's phrase again, when he said he stood on the shoulders of giants, that's all they're really offering is the shoulders of giants. I mean, what is the university core in an English department but the shoulders of giants, Shakespeare, Milton, you know, Chaucer, and so on? What's the harm in that? And also, the Ramsey Center isn't saying that you should only learn what might have been from, you know, monastic institutions in the 14th, 15th century. They really are opening their arms to very broad learning. And also, the thing that is so crucial in Western universities is the seminar method. And I had the chance of, if I may take this time, Anne, I had the chance of teaching 9 communist Chinese students who came out during an easing of affairs in communist China. They were, first of all, they were astounded at how much Western students played around with Marxism. They said, you know, if you really lived in a totalitarian state, you wouldn't just fool around, number one. Number two, they couldn't figure out the seminar method. And I was teaching the seminar, fourth-year seminars, in literary theory, literary criticism, so on, which went back to Plato. They did not know there was anybody previous to Marx who talked about art. Now, that's astonishing to me. But they also didn't know what we were doing in the seminar. I mean, they were allowed to contradict each other. And I tried to explain that a seminar, especially, and I try to do it in my foreword, a seminar was heuristic. It was working towards a truth. And that you had to be prepared. You couldn't just repeat something I said because I wasn't going to say anything until the person who gave a paper, who'd done a research paper, gave a paper, and then the rest of them all jumped in and talked about it and criticized it or praised it or asked questions. And I think the seminar method, which is also this, which is really what the Ramsey Center is offering, I see nothing wrong with that. It is heuristic. It is at the very heart of learning and at the very heart of working towards truth. And anybody who doesn't like that, I think, has to be a little off the rocker, you know? As I mentioned in my paper, bombastic and bent, blustering, bombastic, and bent. That I got from just reading some of the opposition to the Ramsey Center. How can you not want to stand on the shoulders of giants? How can you not want a heuristic two-hour seminar where you discuss things and work towards what you think is to be a truth to take away? Once you get beyond that, I simply don't understand a mind that would reject that. I'm a goner. I don't get it. Unless that mind is blustering, bombastic, and bent. You know? Sorry, I can't do much better than that.
Okay, we've got a question here. Shabbat Long?
My question is looking at going forward and fixing the problems.
We can't hear. I can't hear.
Sorry. The last point David made was an observation made by Menzies that the education sphere should be leading or informing the culture here rather than the political sphere doing it in the reverse way. So we are seeing influences from politics, from business, the economics sphere. So my question is, can we look forward to the cultural sphere to lead the way to an education system that we are all desperately seeking?
Can you get that?
I didn't get that.
Could you just repeat the last line?
It was to David, wasn't it? Did David hear it?
Did you get the gist of the question?
I'm happy.
I didn't get the drift, yes.
Okay. Just repeat what you think is the question.
Thank you. So this gentleman was asking how we can ensure that education shapes our culture rather than politics shaping our culture.
Or the economic sphere.
From
the vocational side of things. So can we? Is the education sphere, the cultural sphere, leading the way in education, or is it the other way around?
Yes. Well, I think to a large degree, politics and influential economic factors have been shaping our culture. It's certainly true that politics is a big shaper of our culture, but I think the truth remains that education is the primary shaper of our culture, not the sole shaper of our culture, but its primary influencer. And in a way, we have to look back to look forward, because in the medieval period, over many centuries, the universities and as they were seminaries in those days as well, were the main sort of incubators of civilization. So the ancient universities, the seminaries, the monasteries were centres of learning that influenced Western culture over many centuries. And looking to today, this is going to be a long process. It's not something that will happen overnight. So those of us in the education business are very much playing the long game insofar as turning our culture around and shaping it through education.
I was wondering why...
Microphone, please.
Oh.
Now, there's a question right down the back, and then I think... No, just let Catherine have her little bit of an answer, but Vicky...
What, should I now?
Yes, just so Vicky will finish with you and wonder.
Yeah. I'll be very quick, and that is, I wonder what you called culture, why you separated it from politics and economics.
They don't have a discussion because
you know?
We've got a microphone.
So,
I'll speak to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah. Hi, Tim James. Thank you both. That was insightful and interesting, both. I live in Warringah. And in that election campaign over the last few weeks, we saw a lot of different things, but what perhaps concerned me and many other people the most was the way in which school children were effectively being used as political tools or weapons or
yes.
otherwise. So
yes.
They were demonstrating, they were at polling booths, they are on core flutes, they're going about media stunts with politicians and wannabe politicians. I know it's perhaps an impossible question to immediately answer, but what are we to do about that, that these young minds are seemingly being herded or pushed to such an extent that they are, and some of these children, by the way, were 6 and 7 and 8 years old, and yet there they are demonstrating against a political candidate or party or otherwise. I mean, I guess the question is, what are we to do about that?
And you might just have to repeat the gist of that.
Whom do you want to...
Okay, so Tim was referring to the recent Warringah by-election. Part of a general election, which was very much a cause célèbre in the culture wars. And so the question Tim had was that a lot of school-aged children and youth were very much influenced by the ideology, if you like, of climate change as a major preoccupation, and how do we sort of neutralise that, I guess? A lot of it comes down to the education system and the training of teachers who generally imbibe a more progressive worldview that affirms climate change and other ideas that are embraced by the left side of politics. And so it's a difficult thing to kind of counter with an alternative worldview. And as I was saying to the earlier questioner, it's something that will take many, many years to overcome, and it's something that parents can begin by instilling in their children, because no matter what school our children go to, our parents will always be the fundamental educators and shapers of our children's worldview. Catherine, would you like to add?
Yes, I mean, parents... All right. Is this working? All right. Parents actually allowed their children to take the day off school to go and protest. I mean, parents are complicit in this too. And parents can be easily cowed. So I think that we have to realize that, and children should not be used, as I say in my intro, using the vulnerable like that, the innocent, or if you want to put it bluntly, children of 6 and 7 are ignorant still. You know, they don't know all sorts of things, and they certainly don't know the complexities that nobody's ever agreed on yet, except politically, the complexities of climate change. But to use children when the voting age is 18 or whatever here, and I think that's disgraceful. I think it is one of history's crimes. Hitler did it, the Hitler Youth Movement. And I find that disgraceful. And but we have to be aware and not sentimental about it, that parents also can be complicit. And so I agree with David that whatever has to be done must be done in the long term, but it has to be done with no fiddle-faddle, with feeling that using children like this is a very wicked thing to do, very wrong to make them feel that they know something so complex and that, in fact, somebody like Tony Abbott is anathema. And so they don't know anything about that at all. In fact, Tony Abbott reviewed our book, and I really thought would it be a political review? And it wasn't. I have it here tonight. It's in my Ur text. It was a sensible and deep review by a man who really thinks and who doesn't just react politically and so on. I was very impressed with it. And when he lost in Warringah, I thought, well, maybe he should sit down now and write. He can think, he can write, and maybe do what Churchill did. Churchill went on to write all those histories of Britain and win the Nobel Prize, although today I know it goes to people like Bob Dylan. But nevertheless, you know, that great poet. But nevertheless, someone should take a stand on using children like that. They should not be carrying placards they don't understand, and they often misspell. They should be in school, and they should not be taking part in the intricacies of an election that they don't yet understand. That, I think, is really a wrong thing to do with your children, and parents are complicit in that, as well as the teachers.
Okay, Dr. Bunsey, could I take you to the practicalities of junior and secondary school education, of how the problems associated with it? To my mind, it seems that the problems are really in teaching methodology, the change from teacher-centered education to child-centered education, which has totally changed the nature of the classroom in junior education. The other problem is curriculum. The curricula, I should say, has been changed right through junior and secondary school to introduce subjects of gender equality and so on. The thematic themes, as you, I think you said in the introduction, rather than narrative themes and an understanding of subjects as a whole.
Yeah, okay, I think the question might get picked up. Yeah. Can you answer that? We've only got a couple of minutes.
Only a couple of minutes?
Set up the question, Catherine, a little bit, because it might get picked up on the mic.
Well, I'm not sure that I could sum it up so simply, but certainly in terms of the curricula, nobody's doing anything about the curricula. And you were also talking about teachers' education, is that right? Of course, I was present at the faculty meeting when education department wanted to become a faculty. To become a faculty, it loaded education with all kinds of stuff. Plato, stuff you didn't need. And in fact, there was a lot less contact with students and a lot more stuff that you didn't really need. And I have a very rigorous way of showing this to my, or finding out about this. My husband went to work at the teacher's college as a mail clerk when he was 14, before he did all his university and his PhD and all the rest at night school. Anyway, he has the 1943 curriculum of the teacher's college. It is fair to women. It is absolutely fair to women. It is sensible about every aspect of education, and it's there in black and white. And if you published it tomorrow, people would be astounded at how advanced and what high quality was there in the teacher's college in 1943. As for the curriculum, people keep just talking about throwing money, you know, Gonski, throw money, everybody's supposed to be throwing money and so on. Nobody gets down to the curricula because they're so bent. They're so twisted. And I must say, I always am interested in what my grandchildren are doing because I keep an eye on it as a sort of temperature of silliness and of irrelevance or of political correctness. But the curriculums should be exposed. The curricula everywhere should be actually hung out so that people can see what's there, so that, you know, if you're not learning Milton, what are you learning? One of the things people don't realize about education is this very simple fact. I think an economist would call it your cost, the cost foregone. When you study something, it's at the expense of something else. You know, if you're going to study a stupid thing like magic comics or whatever they're called, or adventure comics or something, instead of Milton, and after all, Milton's got some pretty well sci-fi stuff there, hasn't he? But if you're going to study that, it's at the expense of something else, because you only have whatever it is, 9 to 3, and you only have the child till 18, and so on. So that when you make a choice, you are making a choice not to do something else. And that has to be a very, very responsible choice. Magic comics or Shakespeare, you know, that's a very important choice in a person's life.
What would Menzies say about the way it's all panned out in terms of what he imagined the university education would be and what it's become?
Yes, well, I think he would first of all welcome the growth and expansion of universities, and he would be very pleased with the quantity, but when it comes to questions of quality, he would certainly have questions in his mind about the sort of role that universities are playing today. Are they just utilitarian degree factories for commercial gain? Or are they citadels of learning that nourish our culture and civilization by moulding young men and women into people of character? And I think he would despair at the lack of focus on that latter objective in our modern public universities. And I think also he would welcome the growth of new smaller universities and liberal arts colleges that return to that original ratio desiderandi, if you like, or original purpose of universities to educate and cultivate character.
Thank you. Well, we had quite a discussion tonight in the most unusual format. And we went back, we saw the vision, we've come forward, and we've wondered where it all went. But to Catherine and to David, thank you very much. You've started the ball rolling. Let's hope the discussion keeps going.
Thank you indeed. Wonderful.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.